So as many of you have been mischievously reminding me, in the upcoming weeks, we are preaching on Daniel's 70 weeks this week. Several of you saying things like, glad it's not me. And I don't know what to make of that. But this passage has been called by one of the most authoritative commentators on this, the great dismal swamp of the entire Old Testament. When St. Jerome came to this passage, he listed out 9 conflicting interpretations and just gave up. I don't want to fill you with despair here. But we will be taking a little bit of a different format this week because there is so much that needs to be explained. I'm going to give you a general introduction. Then we're actually going to go through it kind of piece by piece saying, this is what this means. This is what this represents. And then you'll be glad to hear I'll only have 2 points to preach then, not my usual 3. We're also in the interpretation section. When I'm going through explaining it, I'm actually going to use the New King James because it is a far better treatment of this passage than the ESV is. So if you guys are people who need to get your phones out and if you want to have the New King James in front of you, I want to give you a moment to be able to do that. Hear now the word of the Lord, Daniel chapter 9, verse 20. While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people, Israel, and presenting my plea before the Lord, my God, for the holy hill of my God. While I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the first, came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice. He made me understand, speaking with me and saying, O Daniel, I have now come out to give you insight and understanding. At the beginning of your pleas for mercy, a word went out, and I have come to tell it to you, for you are greatly loved. Therefore, consider the word and understand the vision. 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin and to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet and to anoint a most holy place. Know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and rebuild and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. Then, for 62 weeks, it shall be built again with squares and a moat, but in a troubled time. And after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood. And to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. And he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week. And for the half of the week, he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall come one who makes desolate until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. The word of the Lord. Kids! This is not just about time for grown-ups, even though even the grown-ups' heads are kind of spinning a little bit after those verses. They're very hard to understand. But I think God has wonderful things to tell us in those words, even if parts of them are very difficult. But it's not just a grown-up time. God cares about you, kids. He wants you to know how much he loves you, but he wants you to know how best you can love him. So, a lot of you kids are only a few years away from getting your driver's license. Might seem like a long way off, but it's not. I'm dreading those days coming upon our family. So, often when you're starting out driving, sometimes you get in a little bit of an accident, or maybe you have a flat tire, and you don't quite know how to change it, so what do? You call dad, right? So, what if you were just waiting there, waiting for your dad to come and fix that tire, and he'll arrive, and you'll feel safe, and you'll be on the road again, and when he got there, instead of bringing you a tire, he showed up with an entire brand new car for you. That'd be pretty sweet, huh? Whoa, I was just so anxious for you to get here. But instead, you brought me an entire new car. That'd be pretty amazing, wouldn't it? And you would be really amazed and thankful for a dad who would do something like that for you, right? As much as it may seem far-fetched to you, I really think that's kind of what's happening in our passage today. No, Daniel doesn't have a flat tire. But Daniel's in Babylon, right? And he's longing to go home. Just wants to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple and worship God again. But God is actually going to do something so much bigger. Daniel has no idea. They're not just going to go home and rebuild the temple. God is actually promising in this vision to Daniel all that Jesus is going to accomplish to save. And it's bigger than Daniel has any idea. And I think a lot of us don't realize how awesome Jesus' work is for us. We think, yeah, I need Jesus to help me out here or there, but we need Jesus because we have no hope without Jesus, right? Because every one of you kids, I know your parents remind you a lot, and the grown-ups right here with you, we all sin every day. And that sin deserves punishment. And that punishment lasts forever. We can't afford to pay that. God could have made all of us pay that, but instead, he sent Jesus to take that for us, to obey for us so we could be qualified to be in heaven, and then he gave us new hearts, new life that'll last forever to be like him. Daniel didn't have a picture big enough in his mind for all that, so that's what this vision tells him. So when you guys are thinking about complaining that you don't have enough, I wish I had that, I wish I had that house, I wish I had those friends, please remember, God's given you so much more than you deserve. He gave you Jesus, and that means you'll have eternal life forever. Can you think about how awesome that is and ways you could thank God for that during the sermon? All right. Thank you for listening, guys. So, gave you a snapshot of the interpretation of this passage with the kids here. And so I've already kind of tipped my hand. I'm going to ask you the question, is this passage ultimately about good news or is it about tough news? I don't want to say bad news because even as God has prophesied a lot about the coming of Antiochus Epiphanes and all the suffering his people will go through, he includes in those visions promises of hope. He's even foreshadowed the Antichrist and given us hope. And the reason why people get so frustrated about this passage, one, the Hebrew is incredibly obscure. And so you're reading different commentators and you're looking at their translations of this passage and you're wondering if they're even looking at the same part of the passage of the Bible. But the stakes are high for this because ultimately, is this going to be things accomplished by Christ? Or the other side says, is this about the Antichrist? No small disagreement. And there's a third voice that's a little bit, I don't pay as much attention to, it's much more liberal, that says, no, this is all about Antiochus Epiphanes, just like chapter 8 was. And there's 1,000 other interpretations thrown in there as well. But ultimately, what I am going to defend for you and hope you can see and rejoice with is this passage is about good news. This passage is not about the Antichrist. This passage is about what Christ will do. And we'll see why people get tripped up and think it might be Antichrist. What's crucial to see here is the context of this vision. This is God's answer to Daniel's plea to send them home because 70 years are up. And we saw last week the amazing picture of Gabriel flying swiftly to tell Daniel, you're greatly loved. And then this vision is God's answer to going home. We need to remember Scripture's interpretation of why they were there for 70 years. It wasn't just a random time period. The 70 years was to make up for the fact that they had never practiced their Sabbath years. We read this last week in Leviticus, Leviticus 26:43. But the land shall be abandoned by them and enjoy its Sabbaths while it lies desolate without them. And they shall make amends for their iniquity because they've spurned my rules and their soul abhorred my statutes. So if you recall, the Sabbath year they were supposed to practice after 6 years, you then let the land go fallow and you rest. And God promised he would provide in the years before 3 times more food so that they would have even extra for that year. They never once practiced it. And so God said, because that's a picture of you depending on me, if you don't offer it, I'm going to get it anyway. The land's going to get it Sabbath. I'm going to make my point. So listen to Leviticus 25. If you want to turn there, I'm going to begin in verse 1. Because the Bible interprets the captivity as the culmination of the Sabbath years. But what we see in Leviticus, what the Sabbath was supposed to culminate in was the year of Jubilee. And that is what is key to understanding these what the 70 weeks in Daniel mean. It is the ultimate Jubilee that we are leading up to. So listen to Leviticus, how the Sabbath years and the Jubilee work together to give us a wonderful picture of the work of Christ. Leviticus 25, verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, and the land shall keep a Sabbath of the Lord. For 6 years you shall sow your field, and for 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruits. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap what grows of itself in your harvest or gather the grapes of your undressed vine. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land. The Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you, for yourself and your male and female slaves, for your hired worker and sojourner who lives with you, and for your cattle and for the wild animals that are in your land. All its yield shall be for food. You shall count 7 weeks of years. Okay, do you see the parallel? Right? You shall count 7 weeks of years, 7 times 7 years, so that the time of the 7 weeks of years shall give you 49 years. Then you shall sound the loud trumpet on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall sound the trumpet throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. And when each of you shall return to his property, and each of you shall return to his clan, that 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of itself, nor gather the grapes from the undressed vines, for it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You may eat of the produce of the field. In this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his property. So celebrating the jubilee was the Sabbath of Sabbaths, This proclamation of liberty. What a beautiful picture as the trumpet sounds on the Day of Atonement. Those who, if they had incurred great debt, had to sell their property to pay their debts, the debts canceled, they get their land back. Those who may have had to sell themselves into slavery to pay for their debts are now free. What a beautiful picture of the work of Christ. And you can see why it totally relates to going back to the land. They're returning to their land. They're freed from their debts. They're no longer slaves in Babylon. A beautiful picture. And so, they never practiced this either. And so, as the Sabbath years are now up, it's now time to focus on the Jubilee of Jubilees. Jubilee times 10, the 70 weeks. How do we interpret that, what that means? Well, so many people insert the word years into the language of Daniel 9 and assume it's 490 years, and they try to impose that time frame on the text and try to say, okay, when does it start? When's this going to happen? When's the 60th week? And that misses the point. Whenever the Bible uses that phraseology, if it's trying to give you a specific amount of time, it tells you what that time is. We just saw that in Leviticus. It said 70 weeks of years and used the word for years. You'll see it next week, actually, when Daniel talks about 3 full weeks of fasting. He actually says 3 sevens of days. He used the word days there. The text here just says 70 sevens are decreed for you. Not trying to give you a specific amount of time, but it's to call to mind Jubilee of Jubilees. And things are going to happen in this time to inaugurate the new covenant, the ultimate Jubilee. And so, Daniel wanted to say, when are we going home? And God says, I'm telling you when you're going to go home. But I'm going to do so much more than you have in mind. You're just hoping to get back there and build that temple again and start the sacrifices again. And that's a good thing to long for while you're in the old covenant. But it's going to be so much bigger than that. And that old covenant one day is going to have to pass away for the new to thrive. And so, the Bible has been anticipating this new covenant's inauguration since the Garden of Eden. Back when God told them the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent, they've been longing for those days to dawn. And so, the way God was going to fulfill that, though, was not on Israel's radar or Daniel's. Remember, Daniel was blown away when he found out, when they go home, there's going to be more trial. There's going to be more destruction of the temple. How could this be? We were just supposed to go home. And then the Messiah would come and we'd rule there and it was all going to be great. And so, they couldn't see past just getting the physical kingdom back on its feet. But again, they also didn't have the amazing promises of Ezekiel 36 on their radar. And to Daniel's defense, maybe he hadn't read Ezekiel yet. It was probably just being written. What did Ezekiel promise in chapter 36? That I'm going to remove from your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh, and I'm going to put my spirit in you to move you to keep my commands and my laws. On the day of Pentecost, that's what happened. The Spirit came now, the Spirit of the risen Christ, for the first time indwelling believers. The Spirit certainly brought them from death to life before, but the Spirit Christ hadn't risen. There was no resurrected Christ to course through your spiritual veins and move you in ways that no one had before. They wanted to just get back and dwell near God in the temple. But what is being prophesied is, I'm going to dwell with you in a way you never imagined. I'm going to dwell in your heart. You're going to be closer than you ever thought possible. My new covenant's better than you can imagine. That's what God wants. That's what God is all about. Not just getting back to daily sacrifices and a physical temple. That's too little for God's plans. And so, God is telling Daniel some of the steps and how this new covenant is going to be inaugurated. It's all about the work of the Messiah. It is not just about what the Messiah does a little bit and then Antichrist has his say. And it's not just about what Rome does either. Some have tried to make the text about that. So, this is about the spiritual kingdom of God, not just the physical, which was on their radar. And I know you're not hoping to go back to a rebuilt temple, probably not something you're struggling with, but all of us settle for too little when it comes to God's grace. All of us cling to it far too little. All of us, if we look at God's grace at all, it's just about daily things so many times. Well, I don't deserve that. God, give me grace and give me that thing, or give me the grace to get through something I need to get through. Those are all good things to pray. We should pray it more than we currently do, but we need to see we need God's grace for far more than just the daily things we face. We need it because it's our only hope. And the more we cherish that only hope, the more we love what the Lord loves, the more we act like Christ. So now, we're going to do the awkward thing we've never done here before at Trinity. I'm going to suggest to you again, if you have access to the New King James, have it out, but I'll read it to you. We're going to go through verse by verse here and just show you kind of what is representing what. And then I'll get to my 2 points. And we'll see what time we get out of here. Okay, no one dread that. No, I shouldn't have said it. Okay, so now back to verse 24 from the New King James. New King James makes several clarifying translational moves that are very important. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. So as I said, the 70 weeks are to call to mind the Jubilee of Jubilees, not literally 490 years. Again, the word years is not in the text. So, verse 25, we hear a very crucial thing that I wish every translation did. Verse 25, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, not just an anointed one and a prince, it's the same person, it's his title. It's a great one too, Mashiach Nagid. It's a title. This is one person being talked about here, Messiah the Prince. There shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times. So what is the decree here? It is Cyrus's decree. People have tried to make it Artaxerxes, which is over 100 years later, which makes no sense. It's Cyrus's decree, the one who was foretold by Isaiah and Jeremiah who would make this decree. It is his decree. And it breaks this period of time up into 7 weeks, then 62, and then one. Again, not because it's a, don't try to translate it into years. It's giving you a perspective on the things that are going to happen. The first week, relatively short amount of time, is the fact that the temple is going to be rebuilt, and it starts in Daniel's lifetime. Daniel could take comfort. What he's hoping for, when we're going home, it's around the corner, and it's going to be rebuilt. You see, with moat and streets and all that, it's going to happen 7 weeks. Then we have a long period of time, and it's going to be a troublesome time, and that's what a lot of the previous visions have been about, right? You see the stuff that the Greeks did and the Romans did. So it's going to be some troubled time there for a while, unspecified, but you know it's 62 weeks. Then, at the end, the crucial week is going to come. And what is accomplished there will then inaugurate Jubilee. Verse 26, and after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. Again, not just an anointed one, Messiah. Not for himself. He's not being cut off for his own crimes, it's for others. And for the people of the prince who is to come, same prince. We're not all of a sudden introducing a new character here. This is Messiah the Prince. The prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. So this final week refers to what Messiah the Prince will do to inaugurate the new covenant. So being cut off, Messiah being cut off, that is covenantal language. If you have broken covenant, you are cut off from the people of God. And that is what Christ suffers for us on the cross. He is cut off so that we are not. Cut off, but again, not for himself. He's accused of crimes, but they're not his. They're ours. Then here's the part that trips everybody up. They think it has to be now switching to Antichrist or been Antichrist all along. The people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. How could that be referring to Jesus and the people of God? Well, we have to remember how the Bible uses this kind of language. Numerous times throughout the prophet Jeremiah's work, God says, I'm raising up the king of Babylon, my servant, to do what? To go destroy Israel. The king of Babylon was not at the time a servant of God, as far as he knew, but he was accomplishing God's work, therefore God calls him my servant, even though he worships Bel, right? Or Marduk, or whoever was his favorite at the time. But God used him for his intended purpose to destroy Israel, to destroy the temple, because it had become an abomination with idol worship. And the same thing happens again. God raises up the Romans, as he's already prophesied he's going to do, because now the temple has again become an abomination. How could the temple become an abomination? They should have seen when the curtain tore, when the Son of God, the Lamb that was slain, that had been prophesied since the beginning, he was slain. How dare they continue to sacrifice as though nothing has happened? And they killed him. And so they continue like nothing has happened. And now that is the abomination of abominations. And so they bring this destruction on themselves, just like the first temple had been turned to an abomination full of idol worship. Now this. Christ relates the abomination of desolation to the temple, both in Matthew and Mark, when he says, you'll see in the holy place, it shouldn't be there. There shouldn't be anything there. The curtain tore. It's over. But they continued on like nothing happened. The Jewish translation of this, an interpretation from the Qumran community, but also the translation of the Old Testament into Greek, just calls the wing of abominations the temple. That's what it is. And so, to inaugurate the new covenant, you have to get rid of the old. And when the old has become an abomination, it gets wiped out. So listen to verse 27. He shall then confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations, again, the temple, shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. Several things here that the New King James gets right. First of all, ESV has completely added a word there to make a covenant, a strong covenant. It's just that word does not exist there. The strong, they're just going to say, because the word means confirm. So they add make in there. There's not another covenant being made here by the Antichrist with the Jews that he backs out on and all this kind of stuff you hear about. He's confirming an existing covenant. This has been what has been promised. That's why the text says he will seal up vision and prophecy. Christ is fulfilling all that has been promised. And that's why he puts an end to sacrifice, not because the temple is being destroyed. It's because he is the final sacrifice and the curtain tore. There's no sacrifices left to be made. This is all the work of Christ. And it's not, desolation is not poured out on the desolator. It's a poor translation. It's on the desolate. It's poured out on those who've been abominating there in the temple. They are laid waste by the ones God raises up, Titus and the Roman army, to do his bidding. So, that's why verse 24, back up again. What's Christ doing? Ultimately, he's anointing a new holy place. The Messiah is the new temple, and we are gathered in him. That's ultimately what the new covenant is about, being gathered into Christ and him dwelling in us through the Spirit. So, that's why the Jubilee connection is so important. It's all about the freedom that Jubilee proclaims on the Day of Atonement. All this language is Day of Atonement language. And Christ, as the final sacrifice, inaugurates that new era. So, gave you my intro. We've kind of gone through, this is what represents that. Now let's look at what we can gather from this. My 2 points are this. We underestimate our need for God's grace, and we need a righteousness that lasts forever. And that comes out in this text, I think, powerfully. And so, as I said, we rarely ever focus on God's grace the way that we should. We know we need it. We recognize it. But I don't think any of us can say, I cling fully to Christ the way I should find all my hope all the time. I think we are often struggling by finding our hope in our achievements, in our accomplishments, in the possessions, in our identities that we've made for ourselves, and don't say, no, I have hope in one thing, not because of what I do, but I cling to what he's done for me. And so I think we see Daniel make a very interesting comment here. And it's on the one hand, incredibly profound. And on the one hand, almost a little bit bittersweet. Did you notice in verse 21, when he said, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at first, came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice. That is, to me, a mind-blowing comment. Look how Jerusalem, promised land oriented Daniel is. He hasn't practiced an evening sacrifice in over 70 years. He was a kid the last time he did that, but that's still his reference for the time of day. That's still where he is thinking. It's the time of the evening sacrifice. Think how hard it would have been for these people with their association with, I have to worship God. I got to be in Jerusalem. God's there. And I need to have access to the temple. That's where atonement happens. Here they are, no day of atonement, no daily sacrifices, no Passover. But you see, Daniel's hope is still not going away. He's still trusting the promises of God. But what's he hoping for? Here's the bittersweet part. He just wants to get back. We can just get back to that practice, get that temple up again. The evening sacrifice can happen again. Day of Atonement can happen again. And it's, I don't know if you've ever seen people who are pleased by something. You kind of feel bad for them. You didn't know what they're missing out on. You don't want to clue them in. It actually can get a lot better than that. But if you're satisfied, I'll kind of let you enjoy this little half-hearted thing you have going on here. Daniel, again, is longing to go back to that, but he doesn't have a clue how big God's grace is going to be, and I think that's a picture of us. I think we would love a daily sacrifice mentality if we could pull it off. We love to think, if I can just do my part, and then I can kind of be guaranteed God's favor, I'd love to have that deal. Kind of like back to what the Reformation was revolting against. If I do my best, God will do the rest. And they rightly said, you never do your best. You're never going to get God's grace if it's dependent on you doing your part. But we love that kind of format because it's more objective. It doesn't require as much faith. And so we find ourselves thinking, I think I'm in God's favor because I've done fairly well lately. And as soon as you trip and stumble, you start thinking, no, God doesn't approve of me because I've been doing poorly. And the devil longs for us to be on that treadmill because he's so good at accusing you. And once you're on that treadmill, it is hard to get off because it seems like it makes so much more sense than the gospel. Earning favor makes sense. It happens at all of our jobs. And getting fired for a poor performance makes sense too. And we drag that worldly way of thinking all the time into how we approach God. And we don't realize how much we are underestimating how great his grace is and how far better it is than the wisdom of the world. And so I don't know how you settle for a daily sacrifice mentality of approaching God essentially, not saying I don't need Christ, but still approaching with a works mentality, maybe not for heaven. I think we all know that, right? But as far as his daily regular approval of us, so many of us think that his fatherly love, perhaps, is based on me. And if I just do my daily sacrifice, if I just keep the works I hand to him up, then I get a general sense of a loving God. And then as soon as we mess up and as soon as devil's accusations are in our face, the work of Christ is obscured and we are despairing. Easy, easy, easy to fall into. But daily sacrifices didn't work for them. And whatever version of your works that you're handing to God yourself, they will not work either. And everyone in this room probably says, well, of course I'm not saved by my works. We know that. But do we function in a way that says, but his approval is based on my works? I think we all do. To some degree or another, I think we all function that way. I've said it to you 1,000 times. We all know God loves us based on Christ, but he likes us based on us. We wouldn't say it that way because we know it sounds ridiculous, but we function that way very easily. And we need something that is not a Judaistic way of approaching God or a Roman Catholic way of approaching God. I did my part, now you'll do yours, right? And what did our proclamation of forgiveness say today? It is by grace you have been saved through faith. It is not from yourselves. It's a gift from God, not by works, lest no one can boast. And if we can say, I did my part, we will take that opportunity to boast to the highest degree. Now, we need something far better than a daily sacrifice mentality of approaching God. We need a sacrifice that'll last forever. And that's what this vision is about. Daniel, it's great for you to want to go back to know what you used to know, and that's going to be in place for a little while longer. But it's going to be so much better than you've ever experienced. So, back in verse 24 again. Listen to the permanence. We're now on to our second point. We need a sacrifice that will last forever, a righteousness that will last forever. Look how permanent all this language is compared to daily sacrifices. 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish transgression, put an end to sin, atone for iniquity, everlasting righteousness, to seal up. It doesn't mean to necessarily close, although it does mean that, but it's to put a seal of the royal seal on it, stamping this as complete. It's done. What I said would happen is happened. And to anoint a most holy place. Look how wonderfully permanent that is compared to daily sacrifices being what keeps God in our favor. Again, this is all Day of Atonement language. Isn't that a spectacular picture? This trumpet sounds. Jubilee has arrived and liberty is proclaimed for those who are enslaved and in debt and displaced from their home. Such great language for God to use to describe what he's doing. I'm bringing you home, Daniel, but home is way better than you ever imagined. For the new covenant to arrive, the old must be done away with. And we see how the Jews clung to the old with all their might, so much so that when the new was announced, they killed the one announcing it and accomplishing it. And we will cling to this daily sacrifice mindset as well, because again, it doesn't require as much faith. We can trust in ourselves, the things we see ourselves doing, and it feels very comfortable. But it is no faith worth believing in. And so, that's why it's important for us to see that the Messiah is the one behind the destruction of Jerusalem. Why did they have to announce that? To make sure people knew this is God shutting down the old way of thinking, the old way of approaching him. This is not just inventing new things to go do. I told you it was coming. I told you it would be temporary. The old would be temporary and the new would come. And now it's happening. It's why the author of Hebrews in chapter 8 describes the old covenant as obsolete and passing away. The temple hadn't been destroyed yet, but the new covenant had arrived on the day of Pentecost. And yet the temple is still, again, operating in defiance of the new covenant, continuing to sacrifice. And so the author of Hebrews is writing to a group that's having a hard time letting go of the old covenant way of thinking. They're being tempted to leave Christianity to go back to that. And it's why he makes such a big deal about the permanence of the work Christ has done for us. He brought in the new covenant. Was that just Rome coming in here? God used Rome to shut down the temple. There is no place to be making these blasphemous abominations of sacrifices anymore. Done once and for all on the cross. So we need to see how deadly self-righteousness is. Do you see God's rejection of it? Think of the destruction that happened to Jerusalem. Horrifying, horrifying wrath of God poured out upon that city. And he foretold that it would be. That it would be unbearable. That's why he warned the Christians, when you see Rome coming, get out. It's going to be over. I don't know how you approach God with the works of your hands as though he will approve of you based on those things, but please see how horrifying it is in this vision. God pours out his wrath and calls it an abomination. No, you can't lose your salvation over it. I'm not saying you should fear the wrath of hell as a believer. We shouldn't need that to motivate us. We should see if God abhors it and he has given his son for me, then I want to abhor what he abhors. I want to love what he loves and not approach him as though my works of my hands get me favor with him. Thank him for the favor he's given me by giving us his son. The daily sacrifice approach will seem like it'll work, but it is wearying and it will destroy you. Because your works are never, ever, 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 ever enough. And the devil will remind you how they all fall short. What we need is what the author of Hebrews reminded the people thinking about leaving for Judaism need as well. In Hebrews chapter 10, verse 10, what do we hear? Every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices which can never take away sin. Do you hear the wearying drudgery that he describes there. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. Isn't that awesome? Do you hear how that reflects the permanence of the language there in verse 24? He sat down. He's done. There's nothing left. Told you many times, one of my favorite literary devices is understatement. And that's my favorite understatement in the entire Bible. Yeah, he went up, sat down. Think what it means that he sat down. There's nothing left. I don't have to keep wondering if I've done enough for a Father to approve of me. Christ came to earth, lived a perfect life in my place, gave it to the Father, who gave it to us as an inheritance, and it's done. If you struggle to believe that God truly loves you, as much as he loves Christ, remember these verses. Once and for all time, he's made you perfect. But I still sin. Yes, but you're covered with Christ's perfection, and you are destined for a life truly free of it when you finally see him face to face. We cannot afford to take that lightly, because if we do, we become slaves to the daily sacrifice mentality. That's what the Galatians did. Remember, Galatia said, yes, Christ is fine, but you have to have enough works to qualify as well. And they trusted in this old law-keeping from the old covenant. Again, the Christ had already come, and this abomination is still going on. And news of that abomination is being spread throughout the church, people trying to drag them back into that mentality. Listen to what Paul said to them when they were thinking of drifting back that way in Galatians 4. For it is written, Abraham had two sons, one by a slave woman and one by a free woman. But the son of the slave was born according to the flesh, while the son of the free woman was born through promise. Now, this may be interpreted allegorically. These women are two covenants. One is from Mount Sinai in Arabia. She corresponds to the present Jerusalem. Sorry, I lost my place here. Sorry, there we go. Sheesh. She corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem that is above is free, and she is our mother. So, brothers, we are not children of the slave, but of the free woman. For freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. Do you see how much we miss when we make this about the Antichrist? It's such a beautiful picture of the work of Christ. And those who are enslaved to thinking, no, I approach with the works of my hands. Present Jerusalem, he says, God's not there anymore. Those are all children of the slave woman. They are not my people. When you approach with the works of your hands, it says Christ has not done enough. No one in this room would say Christ hasn't done enough, but our actions speak that for us. And when we get on that treadmill, we are so much a slave. And here they are longing for the Jerusalem, longing for that to be restored again. And you and I are children of the free woman. The Jerusalem that is above is our mother. And that one is free. The freedom of the Day of Atonement, the freedom of Jubilee, the rest we have in the ultimate Sabbath of Christ is all yours while we look away from it to anything else for our hope. Christ has made an end to sacrifice. He's sealed up vision and prophecy, and he has brought us everlasting righteousness. That is what this vision is about, and what an answer to Daniel's prayer, and what a depiction in words that matches the description that he was given when Gabriel was sent swiftly in flight to tell him he was greatly loved. You are all loved far more than you understand, because you're loved as much as the Father loves Christ. And when you doubt, remember the incredible pictures in this vision. And that they're designed to comfort people in exile like us who are longing to be home. And it reminds us that our home is so sure and guaranteed because it's been won for us by Messiah the Prince, who has destroyed the old ways of approaching by works and has opened up for us once and for all by a single sacrifice a way into the throne room of God, where we can actually go boldly, the author of Hebrews tells us, boasting in Christ alone. We need a sign that tells us all this is actually true, because it can seem easily way too good to be true. So elders, deacons, come forward, and let's celebrate the sign God's given us that preaches to us this very same gospel. And it lets us see and touch and even taste that the Lord is good.